Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a social media conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Social media, as in the digital platform and websites that allow people to create and interact with each other and various content. Snapchat, Facebook, Instagram, X, TikTok, Reddit. There is good, bad, and tragic when it comes to social media. The good is staying in touch with people, quick information, community, business promotion, support, learning, advocacy. I like tracking my kids and husband and having information at my fingertips. The bad is misinformation, privacy breaches, cyberbullying, addiction, wasting time, scams, and fraud. I've been accused of doom scrolling, not a healthy habit. And then there is tragic. Tragic is when someone dies. Alexander Neville died at 14 years old after buying what he thought was oxycodone on Snapchat. You can listen to my High Truths conversation with Amy, Alexander's mom. A 12-year-old boy died after doing a TikTok choking challenge. Amanda Todd died by suicide at age 15 after cyberbullying and blackmail. Molly Russell was 14 years old when she died by hanging herself. Before she died, she interacted with 16,300 pieces of Instagram content, 2,100 of which were related to depression, self-harm, or suicide. She binged graphic and romanticized self-harm content up to 2 minutes before she died. It seems that if social media can censor elections, pornography, and what they deem to be fake news, they should be able to remove drug dealing and other dangerous content. To learn more about social media, I reached out to Mark Berkman. Mark Berkman is an attorney who serves as the CEO of Organization for Social Media Safety, which he has grown into the world's preeminent consumer protection organization focused on social media. As a globally recognized expert in social media safety, Mark has testified before Congress and was featured in notable newspaper publications. To learn more about Mark Berkman, check out the High Truth show notes. I recorded this conversation with Mr. Berkman on July 18th, 2025. This is my last recording before pausing High Truths as I prepare for a position at the White House. Until then, I hope your day continues to bring you High Truths. Mark Berkman, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mark, we're going to have an interesting conversation about social media safety, but it all starts with your background as a lawyer. Why'd you choose law, and how specifically did you get into this area of expertise?
Absolutely. So I would say I'm a recovering attorney here. No offense to any of the attorneys listening. Wonderful profession. But I'm a lawyer by training. I practiced for a little bit, and then I took that legal expertise and brought it to Congress, where I served as a legislative staffer for almost a decade, and then ended up moving out to California here with my family and served in the California legislature for a bit. And that actually led directly to my involvement with the Organization for Social Media Safety. So when I was serving as a chief of staff for California State Assembly member, we had an incident in our district where a 14-year-old was attacked by another teen that he did not know. associate of the attacker, another teen, filmed it, put it on social media where it went viral. That video landed in my inbox within about 2 hours of its happening. That's how quickly this video went viral. Very typical of these types of videos, as we intuitively know. I shortly thereafter met the victim, whose name is Jordan, met his father, Ed, Ed Peisner. And we got to talking, and we both realized immediately that this was not an isolated incident. And what we now call social media motivated violence, or attacks committed for the purpose of filming them and putting them on social media to get those likes, those shares, and those views, or what our teens today would call clout, those videos were doubling every year since the birth of major social media. And so this was back in 2016. So if you go back to 2016, I was able to have my staff find thousands and thousands of these types of videos scattered across the country being viewed by millions. And so we drafted legislation called Jordan's Law after Jordan Peisner, meant to deter social media motivated violence. So the first law dealing with that issue, we passed that law in California within a matter of months. So a recognition of the need that this piece of legislation was addressing. Now, while doing that, we realized that there was no one else doing this work as a consumer protection organization focused on the harms, and especially the emerging and evolving harms of social media. And so that led us to really feel an urgent need to found this organization. And we did, and here we are. And today we are a national consumer protection organization, again, focused on social media, serving everyone across the country, trying to protect from the many harms that I'm sure we will get into here, including substance abuse and drug trafficking as well. I'll just add very quickly too, we do that through education. So we're in K-12 schools across the U.S. We do advocacy work from Congress down to local school boards on public policy related to social media. We conduct research, and we work on tech solutions. So software that provides real-time protection against any and all of these harms.
Wow. So that was pretty horrific. People are just randomly targeting somebody, beating them up just to film them. They don't even know them. They don't even have an axe to grind. They just want to do it for the likes.
So this issue started out back really with the birth of major social media as we know it today, Facebook. And you go back to 2006 and you could find a few examples of what was then called the knockout game. So this was mostly teens perpetrating, but teens walking up behind someone, trying to hit them as hard as they could to knock them out while they filmed it and uploaded it to social media, again, to get those likes, those shares, and those views. You fast forward today, you really can find thousands of these videos. And most importantly, you could find them viewed by millions of people, especially being viewed by our teens and even our tweens. And we have found across the country, it's about 90% of fifth graders have seen explicit real life violence on social media. And so the point, one of the points for us as an organization is that these harms that affect millions really grow in plain sight without recognition, without preemption, without public policy adjusting or education. And so that really is our point of existence, to preempt these before they're impacting millions. Drug trafficking is a good example of that as well.
Yeah. What happened to Jordan?
Jordan, he suffered some very serious lifelong injuries, but and I could say this because I've obviously worked with Ed many years and heard him say this. Ed is very grateful that Jordan's around. A lot of the families that we work with, tragically, are not so lucky. So Jordan's here, he does carry some injuries with him, though.
Yeah, I imagine he had head trauma, traumatic brain injury.
He did have traumatic brain injury, unfortunately. So that is really a lifelong injury. I think especially a lot of young people don't realize that. We see on TV and movies and now social media a lot, people getting punched all the time. But you get that.
Yeah. I know. On TV, they get punched and they bounce back right second and their suit's not even wrinkled. And in real life, it's just not like that.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, you carry, and that has a number of associated issues that come up. He has permanent hearing damage as well from that punch. So there are some issues, unfortunately, to carry around from one punch.
You're meeting a lot of parents who've had tragic loss and horrific stories as the ones you've mentioned. And that's your job, to advocate for them. What toll does it take on you?
It's a very, it's an excellent question. So we were actually, because of a very generous donor, we were able to have an in-person staff retreat. We're a national virtual organization. So we have our team spread across the country, and a donor who wanted to focus on well-being of nonprofit staff, provide some funding so we can meet together and do some work. And we had a facilitator, give her a plug, Rebecca Green, who did some work actually on protecting, on stress resilience and protecting well-being. All that said, the short answer is it absolutely takes a toll, because we see every single day some of the worst outcomes here, and they're really horrifying. They stretch across demographics, really children who are kind of innocently going about their lives and then suffer some really horrific tragedy because of this use of social media. And it all seems so unnecessary, so tragic, so preventable. And we work with a very dedicated, brave group of parents who've been impacted by this, and really touching, but certainly it takes a toll. And we are very mindful as an organization of how to maintain our own well-being and do this work as best we can in a way that allows us to make it sustainable for human beings to do the work.
Yeah, that's important. I think you dissociate a little bit as an emergency physician. When I'm working and doing something, it doesn't affect me. If I had to like watch the same thing I was doing on TV, it'd be upsetting. But as long as I'm in action and there's a plan, a purpose of what I need to do, then, you know, that mission overrides the emotion.
Yeah, I would say that the hardest part on that piece in terms of transference, so the resilience piece, is that there is a lot of what we do where there's no handbook, right? So we can't kind of go into a step-by-step process a lot of times. We're looking at new problems and we're engaging with new solutions and we're encountering these issues that really can be novel at times. And sometimes that's challenging in terms of being resilient and preventing what's called transference, right? So that's our challenge there, and making sure that our staff does that in a way that, again, is protective for them and allows us to do the work as efficiently as possible, because the more work we do, the more families that we can protect as well. But too, the well-being and the efficiency goes hand in hand.
Yeah. So social media, you're out there trying to have policies that protect the public from social media dangers. What are those dangers? And you kind of started talking about them. Now you could tell us in more detail.
Yeah, it really is a mile wide in terms of the sheer list of harms that are either caused or exacerbated by social media use. We can start with the most well-known, which is cyberbullying, and that triples the risk of suicide. So this is a very severe threat. We find about 40 to even 50% of teens are self-reporting being cyberbullied over social media. So an astonishingly large number there. There's a whole list of mental health outcomes that have been associated with social media use, from anxiety, depression, eating disorders, and again, all the way down to suicide, human trafficking, drug trafficking, substance abuse, fraud, disinformation. So there's a lot more as well. Sextortion, sexual predation, and I really could keep going as well. And part of our job when we go in and especially educate parents and teens is making them aware of a lot of the harms that are related to social media that they have not even thought about, that they do not know exist. And you can't really protect yourself from a harm effectively if you don't know it exists or what it is or how it works.
What are some of the things that kids are surprised about?
Social media motivated violence generally is the harm that we begin our education with. And so it's a really effective way to start our instruction, because as I said at the beginning, this is a harm that they've all seen, but no one's given it a name for them. No one's had them think about why people are engaging in these behaviors on social media. And so it allows us to introduce a number of concepts that really stick with kids. Why was the first instinct for the 20 teens around Jordan when he got hurt all pulled out their phones to film him on the ground? Only one of the teens picked up the phone and called for help. Why is that? And why is that the instinct? And when we go to campuses and we hear about fights on campuses or social media motivated violence as well.
So what age group are you talking about? High school, college?
Middle school, high school, and elementary school as well. So fifth or sixth grade too. Why is that first instinct to pull out the phone? And so that is one that really we have found really connects with teens and tweens as well, amongst a number of others too.
Yeah. So there's a lot of harm, probably not so quantifiable. I'm wondering if the deaths are quantifiable. How big and how do you measure the problem?
So we do conduct research, as I said, and we do work with teens across the country to get a better sense of the quantitative numbers. So yes, some of this is looking at cases qualitatively and understanding, but there are numbers for a lot of these harms. And so when we get pushback that we're just theorizing or being scared of new technology, the real response, and I said this in front of Congress when I testified as well, because it's a very important point, is that there is discrete, clear evidence of harms impacting millions of children. We know the sextortion rate has gone up, I don't quote me on this, I'm saying it offhand, but I believe about 500%, according to reported cases to the FBI and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. I mentioned the number of...
What does that mean, sextortion?
Excellent question. Sorry, I should define this up. So sextortion is essentially victims being blackmailed to share sexual content or money from an original piece of sharing some sort of sexual content. So to make that clear, one type of case that we see, so someone connects, often with a teen here, right? Connects with a teen, they're impersonating a fellow teen. This happens on gaming platforms as well, just so parents know. So it reaches down to very young children. And they're asked to send some sort of intimate photo or video, sometimes on the promise that the imposter will send one back, right? So you send one, I'll send one. So the teen sends that content, and then they get a message back saying, if you don't either send me more such content, or if you don't send me money, I will share this content publicly. So using that vulnerability to blackmail them, we see a number of suicides from this crime of sextortion. So it becomes so shameful to the teen that engage in self-harm and suicide.
Is that measured? Like, yes. By the medical examiner, do they say that, like, they'll say cause of death, hanging, gunshot wound, but will they also add the cyber problem? I bet you that's not done on a regular basis. They're always investigated.
Yeah, I don't know if it goes into the official autopsy report, but it does go into FBI statistics. So there are FBI statistics here. Suicide is generally investigated. So I do think there certainly is an underreporting there, but I do think there is credibility in those FBI statistics at the end of the day. And importantly, what they've shown is a massive increase in this harm. And we know this happens through social media. The social media is enabling it.
Interesting. I just, Hyde says a drug trafficking era just published their report on marijuana impact in California. And in it, we showed that the highest drug found in people who died by suicide under the age of 25 is THC. But not all counties measure it. And speaking to medical examiners, there's no consistency in this reporting. So I bet it affects the fact that you're looking at FBI cases, I think suggests that that's only a subsegment of what actually is happening.
I would absolutely agree. And one of our focuses in terms of national policy is getting this data in a much more robust, reliable way. We've had a bill pending called the CHATS Act that would basically take right now for our national criminal statistics. What happens is local law enforcement basically fills out a form and that goes to the Department of Justice. And it gets aggregated, and that's how we get our statistics. For crimes related to the internet, basically there's a check the box that says this happened on the internet. What we're trying to do is add some clarity there where local law enforcement has to provide the URL of where the crime took place, because these aren't necessarily on the street corner anymore. It's happening in the virtual world. And just telling us, because when you have a crime on the street corner, we get the address. So we know, and we can kind of determine where there's high concentrations of crime. And so we're trying to add the URL. We're trying to expand the number of categories of crimes that are reported nationally so that we can have some level of accountability for the purpose of protecting, so that we then can knowingly jump in and intervene and protect. But it's a very important point. That data is hugely important when we're talking about emerging, evolving harms, including substance abuse and drug trafficking as connected to social media, because that is evolving so quickly.
Yeah, and I don't even know if people who die by suicide, if their social media is looked at as a cause.
I don't know the investigative routine. I would say, typically, in my experience, and again, I only know it's bad science because I only know the cases that come to us, right? Mm-hmm. Typically, when we have parents that lost a child due to suicide, they do try to, they're very motivated to get some type of answers or information. And when they can, they go through social media. And that typically, based on the cases that I know, is how the sextortion is found. So they find the threats, they find the messages, they find the content that was originally shared. I think often that's the parents doing it and not necessarily law enforcement going through the content themselves.
How big a problem is drug dealing on social media?
It's a massive, massive.
Do we quantify it or is that too hard? But I mean, we know that it's all around us, but.
I think quantifying it would be tremendously helpful. I don't know of any good quantification there.
Yeah. But I think it's well known that your phone is your drug dealer.
Yes. I mean, we know it just from speaking to people across the country, which again, is not perfect science, but it's enough evidence to tell us all that we need to react here. And there's a lot of advocates doing this work out there who tragically lost children. Dr. Laura Berman, who's on our board, tragically lost her 16-year-old son, Sammy, who was dealt fentanyl. He didn't know it was fentanyl, but dealt fentanyl via social media. Her husband, Sam Chapman, is also a true warrior.
And Sam is the one who put us together. That was a podcast, Sam Chapman, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a tremendous advocate on these issues and are really making change here. But this really, going back, I think it was really helpful that you started with our origin story, and we started with social media motivated violence. Drug trafficking through social media came on the scene very suddenly. And it took years for the social media platforms to even recognize that there was an issue. And this was while parents of children who were no longer with us were screaming out for some sort of recognition for a while. COVID was this big period where it really took off amongst children. And there was such a lag time in catching up here, which was and is tragic in terms of the outcomes.
Yeah. Let's talk about the technology part of this. Is there an off switch? Is it even possible to say, if we wanted to, turn off drug dealing, human trafficking? I think cyberbullying may be a little harder because it's more discreet. What is it? But these clear signs, drug dealing, that seems to me pretty black and white. Is there a way to control that, to turn that off?
I mean, there is a number of things. Yes. I mean, the short answer is there's a number of interventions. Turn it off completely and get to zero would potentially be a challenge. I also think potentially achievable with the protective technology that we have. It's a holistic approach. So there's, I think, a number of interventions that need to work together. This is also how we're set up as an organization. So you need the education, both in terms of social media safety and also separately in terms of the dangers of substance abuse and that field, which is not our expertise. The work that's being done in terms of educating on the risks of fentanyl, I think, is having a very positive impact amongst young people. So that education is important. Public policy is very important. We are focused on a piece of legislation called Sammy's Law, named after Sammy Chapman, that would require social media platforms to give parents the choice to be able to use what we call third-party safety software. So this is software not connected to the social media platform like TikTok or Snapchat itself, separate software. And what it does is it can provide parents alerts when dangerous content comes across a child's account. And so if you take Sammy's case, with a dealer reaching out, a parent would get an alert, and that really would be all the deterrence you need here to prevent the child from engaging in what is very accessible.
So this software is available?
The software is available now. The problem is that the social media platform has to cooperate. It has to allow that access between the child's account and the chosen safety software provider. And we're talking about existing companies like Bark, B-A-R-K, a company that we strongly endorse. Bright Canary is another good company as well. And these companies can do that work and send alerts and protect children from a range of harms, including drug trafficking. It is unconscionable that there are platforms that do not allow this access because it's life-saving, especially when they know that children are dying because of activity that's happening on their platforms.
Does Snapchat allow it? There's a lot of focus Snapchat on Snapchat.
Does not allow it. And it is again, it is unconscionable.
And what is their excuse when you ask them, hey, why don't you do this? What do they say why they cannot, don't want to do so?
They mumble it. I mean, I can't give you a good reason at the end of the day. I would say in my own words and
Does
in
it
my
cost them? Is it if they don't, if you have
it's
that, do they make less money because you are less clicks or something?
yeah, I mean, I would strictly say in my own opinion, it is business reasons. Their concern, again, in my own words, is that children, this is an app that enables teens to, and tweens are on it, as we well know, to engage in self-deleting messages. And so we see cyberbullying from that, we see sexting from that, we see drug dealing from that. And so their concern is that they will lose users, and this is how their stock price is valued, right? Based on number of users and engagement, to platforms that have not enabled third-party safety software. So children will migrate to, teens will migrate to other platforms. That, in my opinion, is the reason. This has nothing to do with them as a company saying, how are we going to best protect our child users? Because the answer to that would be obvious and allowing safety software.
It seems like, the safety technology is kind of downstream from what should happen. I know on a, on the upstream level, companies can censor pornography, right? I posted a little Miss Lucy had a baby. She named her Tiny Tim, kind of cute little video of my kids in a bathtub, and that was censored because there were kids in a bathtub. That was considered pornography. So there's a way to do that, but that's not happening.
There is a way to do that. It is not happening effectively, and the trend, in our opinion, is getting worse in terms of what they're taking down. A lot of this also happens on Snapchat as well. So none of those are censored, direct or content moderated snaps between people or groups of people too. So that is a whole space where a lot of dangerous activity is happening where there just is no moderation. And so we do have this intervention that's already proven effective at protecting millions of children out there that's being blocked that could provide life-saving protection. And again, it's really inexplicable. And so Sammy's Law is our effort there to make sure that that can happen. That's one of a few very important pieces of legislation that I think can make a lot of difference here.
Yeah, it seems like as a lawyer, this is a question as a lawyer, you're not allowed to deal drugs via the mail, right? Would it be analogous to say not dealing through social media to give that the same kind of effect?
I think the criminality of the dealing and the trafficking is clear. It's just that social media is enabling this activity and making it more effective, making it easier to get away with. When this happened with Sammy, we could replicate in about 2 to 3 minutes the ability to get on and connect with a drug dealer and get a drug menu. And then in Sammy's case, and this happens across the country, the dealer just comes and drops it off at your house like a pizza. And so the ease of use here is really unprecedented. And I know that Sammy's parents will say this a lot. He was home during COVID. They thought he was safe. He wasn't out at parties. And you used to have to go out. You used to have to make certain connections to engage in this type of activity. And that accessibility is really unprecedented, throwing this
Yeah.
into the mix of this, and then you add that with fentanyl, and it's really a some.
I visited a marijuana dispensary during COVID with the masks and everything, and the Walmarts were empty, but the pot shops were open, and the way that they distributed that, the dispatch center being able to deliver and the ease of it, and I thought, wow, wouldn't it be nice if I could get my prescription medications brought to my house in such an easy manner? Yeah.
It's true. I mean, unfortunately, in the case of these other drugs and with teens, it's a deadly combination there.
Yeah. The Organization for Social Media Safety. We've talked about that's what you do. But in general, what your mission is just safety in all measures, or to expand upon that?
We are focused exclusively on social media. So our mission is to make social media safer for everyone. And we do that using a classic consumer protection model, which is fancy nonprofit babble speak, I know, for an organization having those four departments. So education, research, advocacy, and technology. We bring those together with the goal of identifying all the harms emerging, evolving, that are caused or exacerbated through social media use. And again, with the goal of mitigating those threats and protecting the public from them.
I saw on your website, your board of directors and your advisory council, it's like person after person of who's who in this field. Very impressive. Is this a bipartisan effort?
This is staunchly nonpartisan, I would actually say. This is an issue and a threat that impacts every demographic across the country. And to quote Sam Chapman, children have no party, right? I mean, we serve everyone, especially children. And so keeping social media safe is one of the last remaining issues in Congress that is bipartisan or nonpartisan. And keeping this issue nonpartisan is tremendously important for our families out there, because that's how we see progress. That's how we see impact. It's just not partisan either. It's just protecting families from harm that everyone can see with their plain vision is out there. So yes, it is staunchly nonpartisan. We have bipartisan sponsors on the legislation we run. That includes Sammy's Law. There are two Democrats on that bill and two Republicans. So we are very mindful of making sure that everything we do works across, hand in hand, across the political spectrum.
What pushback are you getting in trying to pass Sammy's Law that would allow these safety softwares to apply, or any other legislation that you may have in this space?
Yeah, I mean, I think the fight with Sammy's Law, because it's a targeted bill that can be a bit technical. And so the big hurdle is just teaching and raising awareness about what safety software is and how effective it can be. The other pushback, which I think is very much a mistaken bit of pushback, is on privacy. And Sammy's Law is actually a bill that significantly improves privacy over the status quo. So what we find in the absence of effective safety software is that parents are now in a much larger way starting to understand the dangers and threats of social media. And we could get into a longer conversation about why all the tweens and teens are still on it, which is a separate issue. But in that desperate bid to protect their children, they are manually reviewing accounts, they are using spyware, they are duping accounts, their child's account on the parents' phones. And so they're getting access into everything that their children are doing, but it's much, much less effective, because the amount of content that middle schoolers and high schoolers are sharing over social media, no one can keep up with.
Yeah, so, the adults can't, for sure.
Exactly.
And they scroll. You watch them scroll. They're like way fast. Like, what? How did you even see that?
Exactly. And so it's not effective, but you're getting all this data that as a parent you don't necessarily need or want. And what safety software does is it identifies the harms and sends the parent alerts just on the identified harm. And so it actually preserves all the privacy. And everyone agrees that if there's a harm happening, parents should know about it. And so it really does both improve safety and improve privacy at the same time. So I think we've resolved that tension in the bill. And the bill's very carefully crafted as well to put a lot of guardrails in there. It adds to data security for the safety software industry too. So I think it's going to be very hard for the industry to come up with a coherent response to this, because again, as we suggested before, their concerns are revenue, consumer engagement, dollars and cents. There's no policy reason to oppose to Sammy's law.
It's the same old story, right? Profits over public health.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. You do a lot of courses in education. Tell us about that.
Yeah, thank you for asking that. So we are in K through 12 schools across the United States. We teach students a comprehensive social media safety curriculum, giving them the skills that they need to be safe if their family chooses to allow them onto social media, which is in the high 90 percentile across the country. So most teens and even tweens. We teach parents as well, and we consult with school leaders and administrators and school districts on social media safety policies. We have a free parent course available on our website as well, socialmediasafety.org. That's intentionally a very comprehensive course there that covers almost the full range of harms and teaches parents our system for social media safety. So we don't like kind of these ad hoc tips that parents find hard to deploy on a day-by-day basis. We give parents a full system to implement in their homes to maximize safety for their children. That's available for free. So anyone can access that again on our website.
Right. And you were saying that we could talk about why are kids attracted to social media?
Why are kids attracted to social media is a good question. I mean, first of all, the point I was alluding to earlier, why are tweens and teens on social media when most parents now understand how dangerous it is? And this really is what we call a lose-lose trade-off that parents are facing. The problem is that you get a few kids in the fourth grade on a platform like Snapchat, which by Snapchat's own admission is too young. Still a lot of young children on it. Problem is you get a few on, that's how the children start communicating. And pretty soon you see the whole grade on it, because you as a parent have to then choose between protecting your child from these harms or, on the other hand, putting them at what is a very real social detriment. And this is a real social detriment. If you have, you know, one of the few children in the grade that's not communicating this way, they are left out of friendships and relationships and events and get-togethers.
And you may be saving their lives. I was one of those mean parents. It wasn't social media. It's like all these parties. It's like, no, don't go, no parties.
100%. I mean, parents are let. Our point is, parents are.
I think we should empower our parents to be able to do that. It's okay.
Yes.
That's what parenting is.
Yes, but I think our work is kind of looking at why aren't parents doing that too? Parents absolutely should be empowered to look and educated on these harms.
Yes.
And
yes, that is so important, and that goes into the drug space too. Because if you tell, I may get the exact statistic wrong, but if you tell your children, I don't want you using drugs. I don't want you doing XYZ, whatever that is. Kids listen to you, and there is like an over 90% chance that they won't do that just because, you know, they listen to their parents. And so many parents are like, well, I've had experts on this show that kind of upset me when they said, you know, you're doing all this science and research on drugs. And I ask them, what are you going to do with your kids? And it's like, well, I'm going to let them choose.
Mm-hmm.
That's yep. giving permission, you know, that, you know, if you told them, I don't want you doing this, you have an over 90% chance that they won't do that.
Yep.
Whatever that behavior is that you don't approve of.
Absolutely. We teach that on the side. I mean, not assuming that your children know not to engage in use illicit drugs, actually telling them explicitly by the evidence makes such a difference as you just said.
Yeah. Parents have a lot of power.
Yeah. On the lose, it's really it's an important piece of understanding in our opinion. It's not like, and the industry have said this before, well, if you don't want your child on social media, don't let them on social media. Just like if you don't want them to have soda or candy at home. It is more complicated on the social media side, because this harm, on the other hand, of being excluded is a very real harm. It's not nothing. We've seen it lead to, anecdotally, lead to depression, lead to self-harm.
That's true. You want your kids. I mean, we all draw our lines. Like, I let my kids dress like other kids, you know, even if it wasn't like my choosing, just because, you know, they want to be like all the other kids. They don't want to stand out. But, you know,
some kids are more prone to this, the problems with social isolation that might come from this. So it really is a horrific dilemma for parents. Our goal and part of our solutions is to work with communities, a school community at a time, to move parents over to this choice of pushing back on social media together, to get rid of this trade-off and have them move as a community. But that is part of the reason that we see, despite kind of all the awareness, we're still at plus 90% of fifth graders using social media here. And so the singular message that social media is dangerous is not moving the needle at the end of the day. And so we need more intervention here. Also on the legislative space, on age verification, it's also in a holistic approach. But that's the reason why. And why, you know, to your original question, why do kids want to be on? Because their friends are on, because that's how everyone's communicating. That's how they're sharing things. They don't want to be left out of the parties. They want to be left out of the jokes. They want to know the influencers that everyone's talking about at lunch. This is their social capital. You take something like Snap Streaks as well. So this is a very devious feature that Snap has, where if you communicate with someone on Snapchat for more than one consecutive day, you get this graphic, and then you have like a 100-day streak there. That's how a lot of middle schoolers and high schoolers measure the strength of their friendship.
They're creating an addiction, right?
Creating an addiction. And so these features are built in, and they are effective. And it is your child against a Harvard neuropsychologist with access to an MRI machine. That's the battle that's being waged here. Yeah. And adults as well, right? We're all addicted ourselves. It's because they have very intentionally stacked their platforms with features that get us to use them and keep using them.
Be a geek. It's a healthy.
Yeah.
So, Mark, do you have children?
I do. I have a 13-year-old and a 10-year-old.
All right. Perfect age for this. What do you tell them?
Yeah, they're not always so thrilled with it. So a lot of parenting at this age, and this is what we teach, a lot of parenting is for the long term and just repeating the values that you want your children to learn and the lessons you want them to learn. I follow what we teach really to the letter. So my children are not on social media for the most part, or definitely my 10-year-old is not on any. My 13-year-old, almost 14-year-old, has access very selectively to a few platforms, with time limits, with safety software, with rules implemented, with conversations that we have had about the various harms as well.
Yeah, they're going to thank you later. You never know when you're raising children if you're doing a good job or you're screwing it up until they're older. So now I'm a grandma and I can ask my kids and they say, oh yeah, we had the strictest parents in high school, but they liked it and they're going to be the same.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, it is.
They have to act like they don't like it because that's not cool. But at the end of the day, they're thankful.
They're my own children, right? And I think that they are able to carry on a conversation with others in a way that I think a lot of children staring at a screen for hours a day are struggling with these days. So,
yeah, that's great. Yeah. All right. Final kind of words of wisdom. What do you want our listeners to know? And then what would you want our administration to do?
Excellent question. So I would encourage all your listeners again to go to our website, socialmediasafety.org, and understand that despite the growing awareness on social media safety and the harms related to social media, actually by the numbers, it is far more severe and pervasive than most people realize. And we have our educational resources for parents that we can teach, you can implement in your home. And we stand ready to go to your children's school and help with the entire community there. For the administration, I think we're very grateful that the administration has acted on this issue. Again, that was in a nonpartisan, bipartisan way with the Take It Down Act, which dealt with what we call malicious pornographic deepfakes, an issue that we've been talking about since 2018. And so the administration has already accomplished a lot in terms of social media safety. We would like them to continue moving forward in that respect. Sammy's Law is a key piece of that. You can't take something down if you don't know it's up. And so those alerts are really life-saving and very complementary to the work of the Take It Down Act. And so I'm very hopeful that the White House will continue walking the path with the rest of Congress in a nonpartisan way to protect families across the country.
Yeah, thank you. Mark Berkman, thank you so much for joining the last show of High Truths for now and until we come back.
Excellent. Well, congratulations on tremendous work. Congratulations on the new position. And thank you so much for the honor of being on the last episode here for a while.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.